Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, there is Bill Graham.
Hey.
Hey. We also have our benevolent lord and master, Jordan Raup.
Yes, I'm here.
It really sounded like you were going to go into a James Bondian villain type thing.
Cuckoo.
That's perfect. All right. So, today, special show for you. We're going to be talking about two different movies in full. Those will be The Hunger Games, Mockingjay, M-Dash, Part 2.
That's the official pronunciation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how I ordered the tickets at the box office. I lie, I did Fandango. So, this is directed by Francis Lawrence, written by a lot of people, based off of the... I'm not reading all the people involved in this screenplay, are you kidding me? So, it is based on the book by Suzanne Collins. It is the final movie in the Hunger Games series, saga, cycle, I don't know what you want to call it.
Maybe.
And also the final movie in the Philip Seymour Hoffman cycle series.
Yeah.
Sadly.
We'll get to that. That's kind of a sad end note. And that stars Jennifer Lawrence, Liam Hemsworth, and Josh Hutcherson, as well as a number of other great actors who got roped into it. We'll also be talking about Brooklyn, a film out in limited release, directed by John Crowley, screenplay by Nick Hornby. And that stars Saoirse Ronan, Emery Cohen, and podcast favorite Domhnall Gleeson.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love him.
Yes, he's great.
Favorite. And I want to do a quick plug for a movie that I ended up seeing last night. I won't tell you what it is yet, because we have to talk about the email address, which is podcast@thefilmstage.com. You can write us there. You can follow us on Twitter, @FilmStageShow. And, of course, you can comment on the pages that these are posted on thefilmstage.com. I think that's it, right? That's all the different ways people can get in touch with us. Facebook, probably.
They could follow our RSS feed.
They could. That's
if you're dedicated.
Absolutely.
Actually, this is kind of secret, but since I run everything, if you follow us on Tumblr or Mixcloud, you will actually get the podcast before anyone else, because that is where I post it first.
So if you have trouble waiting, ladies and gentlemen,
it's like literally a 30-minute window. So.
The other hilarious thing. All of your friends and be like, oh my God, you'll never believe what Brian said on the Film Stage Show. And they'll be like, how do you know already? It just posted.
The other funny thing is we don't have like a set time for these to drop. So you telling people that it's 30 minutes ahead of time.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean anything.
Randomly 30 minutes earlier.
Just keep refreshing F5ing that page all day.
Did I ever tell you guys that I met my girlfriend in, well, my now fiance actually, in Houston.
Congrats, by the way.
She was, oh, thank you. And she was telling a friend about me, and he was like, Brian Rowan, why does that sound so familiar? And finally, in the middle of like their work day together, he was like, oh shit, is that the guy from the Film Stage Show?
Oh,
that's crazy. Like, oh, I love that.
Shit, a fan.
That's awesome.
I think that's the only time I've ever like met a fan in the wild. Which is sad. Work on that, guys. So that's our intro. Let's just dive straight into the movie talk now that we've meandered around. Last night, I got to a theater, one of the few theaters in DC playing Brooklyn, to find that the entire thing had been sold out for the entire day.
That's awesome for this movie.
It is. It's good news. We'll get into why it's good news, because I happen to like that film. So I had a big Irish independent film shaped hole in my movie watching schedule. So I went home and I went on Amazon Prime. And I rented The Hollow. Have you guys heard of this movie?
Yeah, Corin Hardy horror movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've heard of it. I have not seen it yet.
Jack Giroux reviewed it for us at a Sundance, and he was a fan.
Yeah, this is a great movie. Wow. My girlfriend and I were very surprised, very delighted. It's a horror film about...
Wait, didn't this guy just get
the Crow?
The reins? Oh, okay, yeah, okay. That's where I know about it.
Yep. So this is the future director of The Crow, if that actually happens. As we saw with the Raid remake, sometimes that doesn't happen. But based off of everything I saw in this movie, I'm excited about that. This is a film about a husband and wife and their infant child who move to a secluded cabin. It's not really a cabin. It's one of those like...
Is it a hut?
No, it's like a stoneworks house. It's like an old farmhouse. Really nice, if you're into that kind of thing. Out in the woods in the middle of Ireland. And he's there to survey trees because the place is going to be logged. And all of the people in town are like, you don't belong here. You shouldn't be out in the woods. And of course, they're right because it's a horror movie. And this movie plays a lot into Irish fairy tale lore. And not to really spoil anything, but also that brain infecting fungus that ants get. You know, the one where it like makes them climb up and then it shoots a thing out of their head.
It sounds horrifying, but thankfully I have no terrible idea what you're talking about.
So it's the horrors of nature meets the horrors of Irish fairy tale. And this movie delivers the goods. It, about 30 minutes in, already reaches the tenor that most horror movies save for the last 20 minutes. And it doesn't stop. And it's great. So check out The Hollow. It's out available to rent on VOD right now. And I just wanted to give a shout out to that.
Cool.
So that is The Hollow. Guys, let's talk about The Hunger Games, shall we?
Yeah, we'll start with that.
Yeah, start with The Hunger Games. We're not going to have a spoiler section for The Hunger Games. So,
damn it.
You know what? We will have a spoiler section. It'll be brief. anyone who doesn't know, we do a lot of metadata work on this podcast, so you can use the chapter forward button to skip through things. So if you haven't seen The Hunger Games, but you would like to hear our thoughts on Brooklyn, just click that little, it's not really a button because it's all on a screen, but you know what I mean. And
click
listen
it.
To that. Click it. All right. So The Hunger Games, : Mockingjay, / Part 2, directed by Francis Lawrence, starring Jennifer Lawrence as the titular Mockingjay, also known as Katniss Everdeen. Here is the trailer.
I've been watching you, and you watching me. My dear Miss Everdeen, make no mistake, the game is coming to its end.
All right. So, brief recap. The Hunger Games takes place in a futuristic dystopia where children are forced to fight against each other for the amusement of the upper classes. Katniss Everdeen has become a figurehead for the resistance that wants to tear down this horrible regime. And this movie tracks her attempts to assassinate the president at the head of all this madness. Guys, this is the fourth film in the series. First of all, we've seen every other film in the series, correct?
Yes.
I have seen the first three.
Okay, as have I. Just wanted to make sure that this wasn't going to be another Danny watches Fast 7 scenario.
Only you guys have seen part two.
Wait, you've only seen part two?
No, you guys have seen part two. I'm just here for Brooklyn.
Oh, okay. Well, how about that?
Yeah, right, I wanted to put that late game twist in the events.
Dun, dun, dun. All right. Well, Bill, why don't you kick us off? What did you think of The Hunger Games, Mockingjay, Part 2?
Well, as the title suggests, this film series by now has run way too long, in my opinion. I think it should have been three movies, maybe possibly even, you know, two. Just cut it off after catching fire. I've read the books, and my big issue with the books was the third book. I did not like the way the third book wrapped up. I didn't like the way it treated its main character, Katniss. I felt like it took the best part of the series, the games itself, and obviously got rid of it. And so the hook wasn't quite there to propel the novel forward. And I felt it just simply ran into the ground. And I was excited about the possibility that they could improve on the novel. And of course, nowadays, it seems like more and more of these book adaptations, when they get to a certain level like this, where obviously the books and the film series are so tightly tied to each other, just like the Harry Potter series, just like the Twilight series, they're not going to make major changes to, you know, change things up or, you know, in my opinion, make them better.
Right.
They're going to basically say, okay, here's our script. We got to whittle away at it. And that's basically what they do here. They add some stuff, but the main bullet points they hit. And I actually think the first Mockingjay Part 1 is actually a better film overall. There are parts of this film that show you why this is a franchise. And then there are other parts in this film that make you realize that this is the second part of a two-part finale, and it just feels overlong. It feels like they're padding the runtime. It feels like the movie just kind of halts. I think Jennifer Lawrence is definitely giving her best performance to date as the Mockingjay here. She's got a couple of showy scenes. Apparently she can cry on the first take and just nail that. And overall, I think most people are going to be satisfied with this film, but I think there's going to be a lingering what if had they had the ability to actually change and better the ending, in my opinion. I don't know. It's just overlong. It just feels long. And I do have to say, I found it really interesting that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is actually throughout the film. He from what I remember, they were supposed to kind of just cut his parts out completely because he had already finished filming his scenes. And you can tell that he didn't actually finish filming some of his scenes because either it looks like he's green screened in or he doesn't have any lines of dialogue throughout 95% of this film, even though he's on screen several times.
Right.
You never hear his voice. And so it is odd the way that they kind of treat his character. But of course, I mean, short of just having him disappear as a character altogether, I think they obviously worked the best that they could with the situation. So,
well, I'll begin my thing piggybacking off of what you said. It's a little weird how they treat Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, because, and this isn't a spoiler, but at the end of the day, he's like the most important character in this entire series.
You mean besides Katniss?
No, he's more important than Katniss. Like, we can get into it in spoilers, but when you really break this shit down, he is the hero. And it's just, it's weird that, I mean, there's no way they could have anticipated what would happen with Philip Seymour Hoffman, but I can't believe they didn't take any more time to clean up their idea than to just give Woody Harrelson a note to read aloud at some point and to keep, like you said, like Forrest Gumping him into scenes and have people point out that he's in that scene. It's just kind of weird. And it kind of goes to my problem with this movie in total. The first Hunger Games I thought was interesting and fine enough. The second I thought was actually much better.
The third, a lot of people think that's definitely the best one.
Yeah, I would agree. They do a lot more to flesh out side characters who continue to reappear, like Joanna and Finnick, who is by far my favorite character.
Yeah, Finnick's great. I love his character. I love the actor too.
Yeah, he's the most fun, most interesting character. He should have been anything more than what he actually is in this. but that's beyond the point. I'm glad that we were able to get as much of him as we did, because a lot of this movie is Katniss and Peeta and Gale just talking about their relationship. I guess.
Yeah, it's the first film where it feels overly focused on the love triangle between them, and it just makes me roll my eyes.
Right, and it comes a little out of nowhere, as does a lot of character stuff that I was talking to my fiance about this, and she said that a character who I felt came out of nowhere kind of feels that way in the books. But, like, we've had the books before they started making the movies. There was a way to spread that out and seed it better, and it doesn't happen. And I think a lot of that has to do with what you were saying, Bill, about how sacrosanct we seem to think these books are. But here's what I say coming back to that. And this is the same thing I said when we talked about the first part of The Hobbit. If you can condense Anna Karenina, one of the most layered, complex, character-populated, emotionally nuanced pieces of fiction into a single movie, and still maintain all that, then there's no reason that any other book should have to be spread out over more than one movie.
Well, I think part of what you're running into, though, is Anna Karenina is old, right?
That's the problem. Like, no one is going to riot over them cutting out the scene where Vronsky tries to shoot himself to death.
I think part of what I'm getting at is Suzanne Collins, from what little I know of the production and how things are kind of run, I think she still has a little bit of control. And so, you know, obviously, just like what we saw with 50 Shades of Grey, some of these other films where it's very apparent that the author is alive, very much alive.
So what we should do is only ever adapt the novels of the dead.
Or that's why Carol is so good.
Rip it out of their hands. Just rip it out of their hands.
So that's the thing. We have to go and kill Cormac McCarthy to get a perfect adaptation of Blood Meridian.
Well, he already gave us what the hell that movie was.
The Road, No Country for Old Men.
No. The counselor. Screenplay.
The Counselor. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I love The Counselor. That's not sarcasm either. I will go to bat for that film. That was on my top 10.
No.
But yeah, that's not even to get into the pacing issues in this film. I mean, this should be the Raid of the Hunger Games films.
And they're at the end of part one, they had the ability to do something really, really wicked with their scene where they're raiding this fortress,
right,
where Peeta is in. And I remember watching it and getting so pumped during the film, and then they basically smash cut and they fast forward to him being rescued. And you're like, are you kidding me? Like, who's running the show? Because if you do any kind of market research at all, the people watching that movie had to have said, hey, show us. Show us the raid. Like, we want to see the raid. We want to see that.
There is one really good scene in this film, and it takes place in a sewer. But it's Francis Lawrence deploying both the demons from Constantine and the vampires from... He just keeps perfecting these CGI creatures with horrifying mouths. Like, that's his goal as a filmmaker. Scorsese keeps trying to find the perfect criminal, and Francis Lawrence keeps trying to find the perfect CGI monster horde. But it works, and it lets you see what this movie could have been like if they didn't keep hamstringing themselves with, like, dialogue, half of an action scene, dialogue, half of an action scene, dialogue, half of an action scene, epilogue, 20 years later. Like, it's frustrating. Because if there's one thing that this movie's trailer seemed to promise, it was a cascade of violence and like warfare, and nothing. Well, they're literally walking a mile behind the front lines, and it's just it raises a lot of plot questions too that we won't even get in here. But this was, you know, we don't want to spend all our time talking about this, so I'll wrap up my thoughts by saying deeply disappointing, pretty boring. And if you've read the books and you already know how they end, I mean, I don't know many book readers are even happy with the way that they ended, so why would you see it?
Because it's the end of the series, man.
It's there.
That's it. Yeah.
We are recording this on Sunday, so we do know that this is the lowest grossing opening of the entire series. So it's,
yep.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that. So I guess I don't have anything to add outside of a couple of quick interesting notes. That's spoiler.
Okay, so we'll say spoilers right now. And everything moving from here will be spoilers. Again, if you would like to listen to Brooklyn without going through the Hunger Games spoilers, click the chapter forward button. Okay, what would you like to say?
Okay, so there's one of my favorite sequences, and it's a beautiful sequence overall. I think it plays out really, really intensely on the screen, but it's when they first come across a bomb that hits Boggs, and basically it's completely out of the blue. The whole team is following Katniss and Gale and PETA and everybody else, and Boggs, the guy that's basically in charge of leading them through this chaotic capital city, is hit with a landmine of some sort, and the whole screen does the, you know, kind of Saving Private Ryan thing where, you know, there's fuzz and the camera shakes, and then all of a sudden it focuses in and you see Boggs sitting there, and everybody rushes to his side, including the one medic, I guess, on staff. And he basically passes away right there. And it's the most interesting thing is the camera slowly pulls back from that to show the other characters, and off to the left, notice that the sister, there's these two gun-toting sisters as part of Katniss's squad.
Who get basically no dialogue.
Yeah, get no dialogue. And it pulls back, and she's sitting there writhing in pain about 20 feet to the left, and nobody's next to her.
Nobody cares.
Nobody's rushed to her side. And
my audience actually laughed at that scene because it's
the, like, most terrible scene. Like, it's so awful, and you're just like, I don't understand what the writers were doing writing that scene. I don't, because it's not in the books, and I don't understand the point of seeing it as an audience, because all we can think of is, wow, what a bunch of heartless bastards these other soldiers are. Like, they don't even, like, I get it, he was the main kind of guy, the leader of this group, but And even the medic doesn't, like, rush over there. It's really weird.
Yeah, no,
she's already
they
died.
Do not give a damn about her.
Yeah.
What I'll say, I guess, since we're in spoilers, Philip Seymour Hoffman, like, his final piece of dialogue, in quotes, is read by Woody Harrelson's character. And like I said, he says, like, "Oh, Katniss, I knew you'd do that thing you did. And, like, this is why I chose you. This is why I did all this." Like, so it's his...
True.
You know, to borrow
Plutarch
from your namesake, Will Graham, this is his design. Like, Katniss is such a passive character, and I think that's on purpose, but I can't tell. And, like, he's just the man. Like, he is the Frank Underwood, and his design and plan is perfect. And it's just weird that they couldn't do something with that. something more interesting, like really undermine her. Like, just, it would be great at the end of this if they just ripped her character apart and were like, we convinced you were special. You are not, madam. You are a figurehead. This is what war does to people. The man who was never in the line of fire was in charge, and you were a pawn, and have fun. But they don't.
Yeah.
It's a bummer. Or make her political. But don't just shunt her off to a field with her two flaxen-haired children and her PTSD-ridden husband. It's not depth.
The other big scene that I really quite enjoyed was when Katniss confronts the train full of, I guess, what is it, District 2 survivors. And she gives that speech. That was that. Those are the kind of scenes that make me realize, like, why this is, like I said, like, that's why this is a franchise. Like, they have those kind of key moments where you're just like, wow, like, I'm into this. Yeah. And then everything from that point on, I remember actually, you know, watching her reaction to the horrors that are put upon the other districts is really gratifying in the sense that, you know, obviously she's supposed to be our main character. She's supposed to be sympathetic, and she's feeling for a lot of these other survivors that, you know, are just basically being massacred because they happen to be stand in the way, you know.
It's a war as hell thing, but it's so lightly glanced over.
Yeah, it's all
love triangle that it's upsetting.
It is.
But speaking of girls with weird names who are in strange lands having new experiences trying to decide between two handsome boys, let's move on to our review of Brooklyn, which is again directed by John Crowley, screenplay by Nick Hornby, from a novel by Colm Tobin, and this stars Saoirse Ronan, Emery Cohen, and Domhnall Gleeson. Here is the trailer.
Step over this way, please. Get out of the line. Next. Passport, please. Welcome to the United States, ma'am.
Dear Rose, I miss you and Mother and think about you every day. The most important news is that I have a job and I'm in a boarding house.
I was glad to see you finally got some letters from home today.
So Brooklyn is the story of Eilish, a young girl from Ireland who moves to Brooklyn under the auspices of the church, actually, and gets a job. Lives in a boarding house, and tries to build a life for herself in the land of opportunity. This movie takes place in the 1950s, so we are actually non-ironically calling America the land of opportunity. Let's talk about it. Jordan Rapp, you didn't get to talk last time, so why don't you tell us what you thought of Brooklyn?
Sure, yeah. So This is quite a lovely film, I would say. That would be the number one thing I would say about it. John Crowley, he's a director who I don't really have much attachment to. I like Boye, which is Andrew Garfield's kind of breakout movie. And then everything since then I kind of haven't really enjoyed. And this is, I think, is his best movie, I would say, pretty handily.
Better than Intermission? My God, man.
But in Closed Circuit, which no one saw.
Intermission, for anyone who doesn't know, is like one of those Pulp Fiction knockoffs that was really popular. And it's actually probably one of the better ones.
Yeah, so this is a movie, actually, I wanted to see it at Sundance, and I couldn't, but I actually think Dave Elric, who's a good friend, he his tweet was perfect. He said, if Nicholas Sparks directed The Immigrant, this is what it would be. And it definitely doesn't have that kind of, like, I mean, I think it's much better than a Nicholas Sparks adaptation, but
let's please say that's,
yeah,
you know,
let's distance
comical.
Ourselves from that.
Yes, exactly. But it does have, that is one of this movie. I don't think I wouldn't be like, you know, in my top 10, and I will talk about why, but I do think it just is like a movie I would literally recommend to absolutely anyone. It's just like kind of a really lovely movie where, they you know, all the characters, there's something to them that you can find, you know, something relatable. And the conflict in the movie is something where it's, you know, one side isn't set up to be, you know, you know, she's not going down a path that you're like, oh, no, don't do this. It's more like you can see they do a really good job of setting up, you know, the positives of her situation, different situations. And yeah. And so I think Saoirse Ronan is just like fantastic in this movie. She just carries it. Yeah. And so we can definitely go into more. But yeah, it's definitely a movie I would really recommend. I wouldn't say it's a movie I flat out love, but it's a movie that, you know, in terms of like Thanksgiving's coming up, like I would just, this is like the perfect movie to take your family to, kind of.
I was about to say, you can bring everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Even your 8-year-old brother will understand and love part of this movie.
Yeah, he'll connect to the brother, the Italian,
Emery favorite family character, calling it right now.
So yeah,
best performance by an actor in a supporting role goes to that 8-year-old kid.
Yeah, it's just a really nice movie. So yeah, I'll hand it over to you guys. But
all right, Bill, what did you think?
I really quite enjoyed this film. I didn't know really much going in. I hadn't watched the trailer. I had just been told, hey, watch this. I got a screener of it, and so I watched it. And I got to say, I really quite fell in love with it. It's a film that treats the typical kind of love triangle, and that's almost a mild spoiler in some way, but you can read that that's going to happen from a mile away. So it's nothing that comes super unexpected.
That's how like literally every synopsis I've seen plays it. Like,
yeah,
they all are like, oh, she goes to America and meets a boy, and then she goes back to Ireland and meets another boy.
It is kind of crazy though, because I have a screener too, and I watched it, and I looked, and it's literally an hour and 10 minutes into the movie before you meet the other part of the triangle.
Yeah,
yeah,
which is crazy.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of ruined. But like I said, I think the film doesn't play that up dramatically. It's just like, hey, this is happening, and you're like, I see where this is going. So I think that it treated that about as well as I've seen depicted on film. I think everything revolves around Saoirse. I think she really, really just gives this charm and just likability, and she never is really making, you know, the wrong decisions necessarily or anything like that. The film has this odd sense of everybody's really helpful, especially in Brooklyn. Obviously when she goes back to Ireland, you know, things kind of crop up here and there, but when she's in Brooklyn, even the people that aren't nice still have their opportunities to be nice to her. It's a really weird film where it just has this just kind of easygoing nature to it, that I really quite enjoyed. It's obviously an immigrant story about her coming to America by herself, and the way it gets into that, I mean, literally the film starts and within 5 minutes she's on the boat.
Yeah.
It's really interesting the way that they just kind of speed that process right along.
It's actually a mirror of the opening scenes of Across the Universe, the Beatles musical, which begins, and I'm saying that not even really as a joke, which begins with the guy already being like, I'm going to America, last day on the job, on the boat, I'm in America. And that's like literally how this movie starts. Like, I wonder if you could play them at the same time and it would actually all sync up.
And maybe just mute Brooklyn.
Well, yeah, because you don't want to miss that musical number.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm a sucker, and I'll admit this up front. I'm a sucker for period films. I just love seeing anything set before the 1960s. And this film definitely fills that gap. And I'm trying to think what else. Oh, the film has moments, certain characters in it that are, we mentioned the little 8-year-old boy who's the brother of one main character, and also all the scenes at her boarding house while they're having dinner are just hilarious.
Just delightful.
Yeah, I have to echo Jordan's sentiment that maybe this is definitely the film to recommend over like Thanksgiving weekend, and hopefully it expands wide enough to where it can take advantage of that if someone's not seeing, you know, grown men punch each other in a love story like that. maybe this is the one to go see.
Yeah, like, you know, again, I'll piggyback off of your opinion. Julie Walters as Mrs. Keough at the boarding house. Oh, my God.
She's got so many one-liners. So many
great things. Like, can we like, stop having a conversation about the Lord's complexion?
Yes.
It's just
yes.
Like, I love her.
And giddiness is the eighth sin.
Yeah. Like, it's a giddy woman is worse than a slothful man and makes a worse noise. I love her. She's great. Jessica Perret is in this,
mm-hmm.
which is always great to see. And yeah. Like every little encounter that she has, like there's this woman, Dorothy, that I guess works at the shop with her. And it's like when her first day on the job and she's really nervous and she's not saying anything. And Dorothy comes up and she's like classic Brooklyn. She's like, you know, did you do anything this weekend? Has this little thing where she like mimics what the conversation she was hoping to have.
The quiet man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's like, I went and saw The Quiet Man. Oh, it takes place in Ireland. I'm from Ireland. I know Eilish. That's why I brought it up. It was just like, I wanted more of Dorothy, actually. And there's so many characters like that in this movie who it's just like, I'm not done with you. Come back. Where's more Dorothy? Where's more of the 8-year-old? Where's more of the cook at the diner who also had a, you know, heavy Brooklyn accent.
Yeah.
He was like, when I go to the pearly gates, the first thing I want to hear when I go through, I'm doing a Boston accent, I apologize, is, you know, you asking for the check in that Irish brogue. It's just like, yeah, more of that. I love the color in this movie, both in terms of visuals and characters. And I just love the even-handedness with which it treats everyone. Unfortunately, my fiance was going to go see this with me yesterday. She couldn't make it when I had to go see it this morning because it was sold out. And I told her after I saw it, it's the rare film where you just want everyone to be happy at the end. And it's not going to be possible because they're not going to like have a polygamous relationship. Spoilers, I guess. And
polygamous long distance.
And they don't like make it easier for her by having you find out that like one of the guys happens to be an axe murderer or is like trying to sell an orphanage.
Well,
like,
we don't know everything about Domhnall Gleeson.
This
character.
Is true. He's still Domhnall Gleeson. That guy's got some darkness in him. But
yeah.
it's just
Rumor
great
is,
to see a movie
on the
that...
dark side.
Is he in the new Star Wars movie?
I don't know.
Stop. No Star Wars talk until December.
He's well. That's I will. This is the one thing I'll say about Star Wars. Everyone's up in a fucking tizzy that we haven't seen Luke Skywalker. I haven't seen Domhnall Gleeson yet.
Who cares? Who cares?
Where's Domhnall Gleeson? Anyway,
I don't know.
But he's in this movie, and he's great, and everyone's great in this movie. There's not like a wrong note. There's not a bad character. Every scene crackles with like life and optimism. And it actually made me sad because I was like, there's a point where the priest is talking about, you know, I forgot, you know, how it is in Ireland and how you can't, there's not as many opportunities for young women like yourself. And I was like, God, where do we go now?
What,
like there is no land of opportunity anymore. I can't hop on a boat to get a job that actually fits my education. I'm stuck here doing this shit.
You could go to China.
I could be one of those people that like goes to China or Korea to teach English because you don't even have to speak their language.
Yeah.
Yeah,
all right. Well, one thing I wanted to point out that I didn't realize until after like reading up on the film and I listened to a couple of interviews and Q&As, and the film has so it's 112 minutes, so it's just under 2 hours, and the film really from the get-go, like I mentioned at the start of my review, was it really has this kind of great momentum. And really, if you think back on her character and everything that she kind of endures, it's quite incredible because just so much happens. You know, there isn't really a lot of dull moments in this film until she gets back to Ireland. When she's in Brooklyn, it's moving at 1,000 miles an hour. It feels like
that's funny because I watched it for a second time today, and that's the exact note I had when I wrote it down. Like the way they overlay her voiceover of her writing to her sister and things like that, and they overlay it over, you know, the scenes that are taking place, and like so you're getting everything at once, and plus the score, which mm-hmm. is quite well done. If even though it is a bit touch too heavy handed, perhaps for my liking, but it is nice. But yeah, but that's a really good point. I was really impressed the way he's able to kind of seamlessly do that, and it doesn't feel overbearing too much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course it kind of folds into her character nicely because she's got a lot of emotions about being in America by herself and things like that. And so, you know, you can just see all of these things just kind of building on her. And yeah, it's pretty incredible to kind of think of, you know, her day to day. And obviously this isn't a real character. This isn't biographical in any way, but you know, it's pretty interesting to see how fast her 1950s life is moving, you know.
Yeah,
we think so much about, you know, nowadays life moves at a very rapid pace, and it's like, well, imagine being an immigrant and then, you know, going to a boarding house, having a job, having to learn, you know, how to talk to people like their friends and, you know, things like that. I love that note from Jessica Puri's character. You gotta treat them like your best friends, every single one of it.
Yep. I loved every interaction she had with Tony, played by Emery Cohen, who I just realized mm-hmm. is AJ from The Place Beyond the Pines.
Yeah, I was going to say, yep. What did you guys think yep. of it? Because his performance in that movie is very divisive. I'll talk to some people who absolutely yeah. hate that last section, and then others who think he's great.
I love that last section, but I think I said it on the podcast that we did, you know, on that movie. He looks like he's 37 in that movie.
Yeah. it's funny because I interviewed him for Place Beyond the Pines, and he is like exactly like a mix of both characters in real life, like the ones that I've seen. Like he feels like he's putting on this almost like Marlon Brando-esque, like, I don't even know. It's like this, like, it's just like in Place Beyond the Pines, it's a little strange. And in this movie, like, it works really well.
Well, in this movie, he's like really like sweet and underspoken. He's like, yeah. You know, your classic. Well, he's not even like a classic.
I love the one shot that I love so much is when they're on like the, it's like the train and like, and that he asks her for a date and then like he doesn't cut, the John Crowley doesn't cut, and there's like a 10 seconds of them like smiling, or him like smiling. It's so, and it's cute. Like, it's so yeah, you're just like, aw.
I want those crazy kids to work it out. But he's great. He's like, he's got this really like, you know, soft spoken, understated thing, and you know, he's very open about his feelings. It's just, he's a good guy. And in The Place Beyond the Pines, he's like a horrible asshole who legitimately looks like a 30-year-old cast member of the Jersey Shore. And in this one, he literally seems like he's lost a foot and like 100 pounds of muscle. So I don't know what the hell's going on, but I like him in both movies, and in this especially, because he's playing a character that's not inherently unlikable.
Yeah.
So do we want to talk spoilers real quick, just to see what we thought about the way the movie ended?
Sure, yeah.
Sure.
All right, so spoilers for Brooklyn. So, guys, were you Team Tony or Team Jim?
I think the great part of this movie is that you can be kind of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I was Team Tony.
I was quite taken aback the first time I watched it that it ended when it did. Within 2 minutes of her kind of coming back to Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
Well, the interesting note that I found out
flash forward to their children.
No. I was just kind of like, I was just surprised, like literally that the structure of the film kind of makes it seem like whoever she ends up with, you will spend a little more time, like kind of getting her decision, like why she decided to almost. I don't know if that makes sense. And then with this, it's like, oh, one embrace and a smile and it's over.
I think it says a lot about, you know, the immigrant experience. You know, you have to, you have to embrace the new place. And, you know, the comforts of home are really difficult to get over.
One of the things I did love is, so we said like every character you kind of like, except, obviously the one, Miss Kelly. And I thought it was interesting how it was her. I assume because of her revealing the fact she hoped it would ruin her relationship in Brooklyn, perhaps, right? And have her stay there, but it was the exact opposite effect.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. Because the whole movie, she has no agency. Like, her boss in Ireland is like, she's like, actually, I'm going back in a few weeks. He's like, actually, I think you're going to stay and until we talk about it later.
Like this weird horror movie-esque trap.
Yeah.
It was
interesting. You know, I'll call the cab. It's like, oh, don't call the cab. You know, I'll get my son to take you back to your place while I work on your car. And it's just like, oh, God. You're gonna die in that gas station.
And the lady that was like, oh, you guys are definitely going to get married. There's wedding bells in your future.
Oh, God.
She's like, no.
Well, it's just that thing. It's like that kind of a place, any small town where everybody knows each other, they want to keep themselves to themselves.
Well, it's funny because I think what Miss Kelly was actually trying to do, and you know, Saoirse's character, A-list, actually calls her on it. She's like, you didn't have a clue what you were trying to do here.
Yeah.
You're just trying to just cause trouble. And I think her intention was just basically make sure that nothing happened with Jim. You know, she was basically trying to make sure that, you know, whatever was going on, Jim was not going to be in Alish's future.
Well, and I think that Miss Kelly maybe was trying for some sort of extortion thing. But that's the great thing about this movie is that you don't know what she wanted to do. So Alish even
was anyone else expecting briefly a change of heart and for Miss Kelly to offer her the store? Because I thought that's what was going to happen.
That's what I sort of thought was going to happen as well.
Only based on all the other characters having a redeeming side. I thought that for a second, but then I'm like, there needs to be a moment in the movie where kind of she, Saoirse Ronan, like, you know, takes back her agency. Saoirse, sorry.
Everyone's, I just can't pronounce either her name or the character's name.
Yeah, I just think that's a really important moment where she has some sort of agency.
The other big part that, I guess since we're in spoilers, when she opens that drawer to drop in the next letter from...
Oh, my heart broke.
Yeah.
I felt so bad for Tony.
I obviously didn't see this in a theater, but apparently that moment gets a lot of reaction from, you know, at like Sundance, at the New York critics screening of it and stuff like that. They mentioned that in one of the interviews I was talking about. And they were saying, and I was listening to an interview with Nick Hornby, who has like a sterling reputation right now. Like, he's got a lot of stuff to his resume that's quite incredible.
Everybody loves Nick Hornby.
And he was mentioning that scene, they had no idea it was gonna play out, because the interesting thing about writing a screenplay is you just write and she opens a drawer and you see more letters and then she closes the drawer. Like, there's no drama in the screenplay itself. And I guess just the way they shot it, you know.
Well, it's all about the build up. I mean, it's proof that they had that emotion, you know, built in.
No, I was like angry at her.
Yeah.
After that guy goes and talks to that crazy little brother of his to like write her the perfect letter, and then she just puts it into a drawer with all the other ones. Oh, I was like, Alish, come on. What are you doing here? So mad. So mad. But, like, you know, she ended up choosing him in the end. And I think that there's a lot to that. I mean, when her sister... Well, we're in spoilers. Yeah. When her sister dies, she says, you know, would it hurt you if I went home? And he says, like, you know, home is home. Like, you know, I'd be afraid you wouldn't come back. And then on the boat coming back, she says, like, you know, no, I'm, you know, America is my home. So there's that change. And her, you know... angry declaration to Miss Kelly, that bitch. You know, my name is Ailish Fiorello. Mm-hmm. Just like, yes.
It's funny because the film almost treats her like this one. Because, yeah, Miss Kelly is the only character really that seems to have any kind of outward ill will towards any other human being in this film. And I remember
Kelly.
I remember watching it and thinking, okay, that's great that she basically and there's more that plays into it, but that is the driving force is Miss Kelly basically gets her on that boat, right? And it's like there are more Miss Kellys out there in the world.
But I don't think you can't run from all of them. Just to get away from Miss Kelly. I think she was looking at this place through these rose-colored glasses, and she, you know, life wasn't all peaches and cream in New York. But she realized that there are going to be people like that everywhere. But in this place, she was the sister of a dead woman and the daughter of a woman who was known to everyone. And, you know, in America, she was just Ailish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you got to fucking rip your roots up and plant them somewhere else. Because you're a prisoner. Like, the guy was inheriting his father's pub and moving into his parents' house. Like, that was not his life.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't be living her life. You know, Tony was literally building his own house. That's the moral argument the movie seems to be making, in my eyes.
Well, there's something to be said, and it's so weird the way that they kind of portray this immigrant lifestyle. And I get why you would want to find people of your own, but the fact that they're going to an Irish dance,
yeah,
is so hilarious to me.
Well, that's what's even greater about Tony going to that dance, because he's Italian as fuck. He is the most Italian, and you know, he says, like, you know, I'm Italian, like, I don't even have an Irish like great grandfather, I just like Irish girls.
it's just so weird to me, Tony. Though, like thinking about the fact that you would move all the way across the continent or the earth, and you would get there and try and immediately find, I guess, comfort, but ultimately, like, it's almost they're not taking advantage of where they are. They just want to make another little Irish family, Irish
and
roots
that's
over
what's
there.
Great about her being with Tony.
Yeah.
Because he takes her out of that. He doesn't just take her to the Irish dance. He takes her to the films and the ball game. And he's going to move her out of Brooklyn, which they constantly say is an Irish alcove, and into Long Island.
Well, it's also interesting that Tony is the one that has his heart is sunk into this baseball team,
and they're going to move
into I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that's right.
No, that he said that, I was like, oh no, Tony, what are you going to do?
But it is so interesting that he basically invests himself fully into a baseball team in America, you know, I couldn't tell how far removed. I mean, obviously he came over with his family. I think he was a first generation. He wasn't born there, was he?
I think he was.
Hmm.
I don't know. But yeah, I like this movie. I think that this is a perfect, I don't know about The Good Dinosaur yet. Maybe that'll be the family film to be, but this is definitely the adult family choice for Thanksgiving.
I don't think it'll meet my
top 10 though. Besides Creed. We haven't seen
There's a lot
Creed
of good
there.
Options. Yeah. I don't, Well, I was just going to briefly mention, like, for you guys, because I do see a ton of, like, praise out there. For me, I know we just spent an hour talking about how much we love it, but there is something kind of holding me back a little bit, like, from fully embracing it. Like, it almost feels a little too spoon-fed every emotion in it.
It's a little hand-holdy.
Yeah,
but it's so effective.
It's super effective, and it is lovely overall. But there's just something holding me back. So I just wanted to say that I wanted to hamper the excitement a little bit.
Yeah, no, I get that, and that it won't end up my top 10 like the Immigrant did,
right?
Because that had a little more to it. But I think this is a beautiful, well acted, you know, conventionally but effectively directed melodrama.
Okay, cool. Just want to be on the same page.
All right.
I think this is easy. Like you were saying, though, I think this is a film that's very easy to recommend just across the board, you know. I think most people will have something to talk about coming out of this film beyond just the love triangle at the center of it, right? So
Team Tony or Team Jim?
Yeah.
Team Tony all the way.
Keep doing that, Brian. Keep doing
I'm gonna
that.
Make that a hashtag, bitch. It's gonna happen.
Can we talk about what's probably gonna happen? Is this gonna get her nominated?
I would love it too. I think she gives a worthy performance.
Yeah, I would be really surprised. It's one of those movies, like we said. I mean, the Academy tends to go for these kind of like, really just by the numbers is too mean of a thing to say, but like just a very
it's
like
pitched at them.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So she get nominated. She
sometimes
won't win.
I mean that as a negative, and in this way I don't. So I would certainly see a Best Picture nomination and an actress in its future.
Yeah. Right.
And it's doing really well at the box office.
Oh, is it? That's good.
Yeah.
Well, I should know that because it was sold out yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, that's good for that
movie.
I
don't think about that in terms of the film. I think about it in terms of how it inconvenienced me.
You're so not like, thank God it was sold out. All right.
No. Like when I had to go to three different screenings of Anna Karenina to finally find one that wasn't sold out, that wasn't a good day for me.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is it for today. Gentlemen, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found. Jordan Raup.
On thefilmstage.com at JP Raup on Twitter.
All right. Will Graham.
You can find me writing on the film stage, freshfiction.tv, and also follow me on Twitter at CableBFG.
You can find me tweeting at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on thefilmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. But ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And tune in next week when we'll be talking about The Good Dinosaur and or Creed.
Yep. Oh, and we also have an interview going up with the composer of Brooklyn.
Oh.
And I'll embed the full score if I can. So.
The one you don't nice. Like?
I know. Sorry.
Yeah. I like the music. The music is
yeah,
fun.
I like the music.
And go, another plug, just go see Carol when it comes near you because it's so
yes.
good.
Yes.
And we'll be talking about that whenever it opens yeah. up near me, I guess.
Early December, probably.
Are we going to have Dave Ehrlich on this for that?
Ooh, maybe. Yeah, I know he hasn't written anything about it yet in terms of he's done a ton of interviews, but not like a review. So maybe
I was about to say, he's been screaming about how much he loves it since
yeah.
I don't even know how long.
Yeah, he hasn't written a long form piece on it yet, so I don't know.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again. And I mean it this time. Tune in next time.